with indignation. "What I am about to reveal is classified, ma'am. I'm afraid I cannot allow you to stay."
"Well, what about Mike?"
"We have reason to believe that your son is already in possession of this information. That is the reason we are gathered here this evening."
"This morning, you mean?"
said my mother tartly, rising with reluctance and moving towards the door. She cast a look back over her shoulder. My father nodded to her in reassurance, and she left the room with a sniff. As the door closed behind her, I heard a female voice gently asking her if she was hungry.
"I do apologize for that, Colonel Young, sir. When you have heard what we are going to say, I believe you will understand the need for this caution."
"Yes, yes," my father nodded. "Although you have retired from your previous position, sir, you are aware of what I mean when I say grade one security. The phrase is familiar to you."
"Son," said my father, pushing out his chest and tapping it half a dozen times, "I've got secrets locked up inside here that would make the guts fly out of your throat."
"I'm quite sure that's true, sir." Hubbard turned to me, a faraway look in his eyes, as if repeating a mantra learned at school. "And you, Michael, you understand that whatever I tell you here must never be repeated outside this room." I nodded, nervously wiping my hands on the cotton of my chino shorts. "You are prepared to take an oath to that effect?"
"Certainly," I said.
Hubbard reached an arm down to the floor, like a man in a restaurant who has dropped a napkin, and came up with a small black Bible. He passed it over to me, tenderly. I looked across at my father, wanting someone with whom I could share the comic absurdity of this, but he was looking profoundly serious.
"Take the book in your right hand, please, Michael."
I did so. The cover, black bobbled leather, was stamped in gold with the seal of the President of the United States. I lifted the cover half an inch and saw with surprise that this wasn't a Bible at all.
"Repeat after me. I, Michael Young."
"I, Michael Young, do solemnly swear,
on the Constitution of the United States of America,
that I will hold fast within, all information tendered to me, pertaining to the security of my country, nor ever reveal by word, deed, or any means whatsoever, that which is divulged to me, by officers of the United States government, so help me God,
"Fine," said Hubbard, taking back the book. "You understand the oath you have taken here?"
"I think so."
"If ever we have cause to believe that you have repeated to anyone outside this room what you are about to hear, you may be charged with a felony. The name of that felony is treason, and the maximum penalty for treason is death."
"That's pretty clear, then," I said.
"All righty, then." Hubbard looked across at Brown. "Don, maybe you'd like to take it from here?"
Brown, still standing, nodded his head and started to pour out coffee, perching a biscuit on each saucer as he did so, one of those big chocolate chip cookies, the kind freckled, crew-cut American kids have with their glasses of milk in 50s movies.
"The story I have to tell you," he said, passing cups down to us, "begins a long, long time ago in the small town of Brunau am Inn, Austria, in the year 1889. Brunau is a dull, provincial little town today, and it was a dull, provincial little town then. Nothing ever happened there. Life just went on. Birth, marriages, death. Oh, the local round of the market, the inn, the church, and, of course, gossip."
Family History: The Waters of Death.
"Gossip," said Winship, banging down his coffee cup.
That's all this place is, a great hypermart of gossip. So, what do you expect? Said Axel, dabbing the froth of chocolate from his moustache with a college napkin. Yes, but there's gossip and there's gossip. I make one casual remark to a student, and before I know it, the faculty professor is breathing fire and brimstone and prophesying a budget disaster. I never said the Sorbonne had beaten us to it. I merely said that Patrice Duroc would probably get there first. You think that's true? Well, it's possible, said Winship, and frankly, who cares? There's such a thing as the wider fellowship of science, you know. Axel chuckled deeply. You believe that? You really believe that? Well, as far as Berlin is concerned, it doesn't matter who gets there first, does it? So long as it's Europe, not America. But the budget masters, Jesus, the budget masters, you'd think it was the future of civilization at stake. You're not saying that you don't believe in internal competition, Axel said in mock horror. Well, it's all right for you. Your work is so important, you can get any money you like for it. How's it going, by the way? Close to getting somewhere? Or is it all still, as I hear, all pi r squared in the sky? You know I can't talk about it, Jeremy, said Axel gently. Yeah, what's the point of talking about anything? Winship rose heavily. Hey-ho, back to the grindstone. Are you off to the labs? I could do with a ride. Sorry to disoblige, but I have a gentle afternoon of teaching in college. Well, sod you then, said Winship in English. I understood that, said Axel with a smile. They parted outside the door of the senior combination room. Axel stood for a while, sniffing the gentle spring air, and then walked at a leisurely pace to the porter's lodge. Morning, Bill.
Morning, Professor Bauer.
Summer's on the way.
Not before time, sir, not before time.
Axel looked vaguely at his pigeonhole, stuffed, as usual, with useless pamphlets and reminders. Another time. He would clear it another time.
You got the message then, did you, sir?
Axel turned. Message? What message?
A teleform for you. Urgent, they said. Young Henry called your rooms, but you weren't there.
I'd been at lunch.
I believe Henry posted it through your oak, sir, but I have the master copy here.
Ah, thank you.
You'll see that it's from Germany, said Bill, handing over a yellow envelope.
From Berlin, he added, with a wistful blend of awe and curiosity. Axel felt for his reading glasses and tore open the envelope. Professor Axel Bauer, St. Matthew's College, Cambridge, England. Dear Professor Bauer, we regret to inform you that your father, Freiherr Dietrich Bauer, is very seriously ill. We have done everything we can here to make him more comfortable, but it is my duty to advise you that it is most unlikely that he will be with us for more than a week. He has expressed an urgent desire to see you, and if you are able to arrange this with your employers, I would strongly suggest that you come as soon as possible. With friendly greetings, Rosa Mendel, Director. Axel was exhausted by the time he arrived at Flughafen Speer. The plane, a Messerschmitt File 6, had been crowded with businessmen whose sharp suits and absurd attention to their portable computers had made him feel shabby and out of place. The stewardesses, it seemed to him, had treated him as if they too felt he was an inferior being. Ah, well, the days of respect for academics and scientists were over. Today it was commerce that Europe valued, and it was the businessman who, having exploited what the scientists and technologists had done for the world, now reaped the rewards and garnered the honours. Honours! It was only halfway through the flight, pondering on this noisy, brash new world around him, that Axel realised with a bolt of surprise that he must soon, and as a matter of course, inherit his father's barony. Freiherr Axel Bauer. Ridiculous. Maybe this explained the extraordinary courtesy and helpfulness the university authorities had shown him when he applied for his week's compassionate furlough.
Somewhere in the files, he supposed, he was written down as the son of a Reichsheld, a hero of Greater Germany. Nobody had much time for such Gloderite chivalric nonsense these days, but there were still enough sentimentalists and snobs around to ensure that a real, live, genuine Baron of the Reich got attention. Good tables in restaurants, at least, and perhaps, when he updated his credit cards and papers, a little more service and respect from these stewardesses. The authorities in London and Berlin, too, had been exceptionally cooperative, considering the high secrecy of the project which he and his colleagues were working on at Cambridge. They didn't like it when unmarried men, working in sensitive fields, travelled, even when it was within Europe. Married men, men with wives and children left behind, the authorities were comfortable enough with them. Nonetheless, they had waved his paperwork through politely and speedily. The taxi ride from the hotel in the Kurfürstendamm in a brand new DW Electric, Germany still got the new models first, he noticed, whatever the avowed public policy might be, was comfortable enough, but while his eyes looked admiringly out the window as they sped through the Tiergarten and past the statues, pavilions and towers erected to the greater glory of Gloda, his thoughts were all for the dying man he was about to visit. This father, about whom he knew so little. Since the death of his mother in the 1960s, Axel had exchanged two letters with the man. Nothing more. Not even cards at Christmas. The director at the Wannsee Hospital was a calm, efficient young woman who, standing under an original oil portrait of Gloda in the lobby, reminded Axel of one of those archetypes of German womanhood in 50s musical shows and films. "I won't keep you long, Herr Professor," she said. "You are a man of science. You will not wish me to raise false hopes. Your father has cancer of the liver. He is too old, I am afraid, for any hope of success with transplantation." Bauer nodded. How old was the man, in fact? 89? 90? How appalling not to be able to remember. "How is he in his mind, Frau Direktorin?" "His mind is good. First class. Since he heard you were coming, he has been much more at peace. You will follow me, please?" Their heels echoed on polished marble tiles as they walked. They passed through an arched corridor, one side of which was glazed and gave over a long sweeping lawn that led down to the lake. Axel could see old men and women being wheeled about in the sun, each with their own starched attendant. "This place," he said, gesturing, "it seems to be magnificently endowed." "It is reserved," Frau Mendel said proudly, "exclusively for heroes of the Reich. There are not so many of that generation left. A little piece of history. When the last of them goes, I don't know what will happen here. You are aware, I hope, that all the expenses of your father's funeral will be met." "It will be a state funeral, then?" She rocked her head from side to side to indicate a yes and a no. "Officially, it is a state funeral, naturally, but these days..." She raised her arms apologetically. "No, no, that's fine," Axel assured her. "I prefer something private, truly." "So," said Frau Mendel, stopping in front of a large pedimented door painted in eau de Nil. "The Freiherr's quarters." She knocked briskly three times with the sharp end of her middle knuckles and entered without waiting for a reply. Axel's father was slumped down in a wheelchair, his head on his chest, fast asleep. Axel felt he never would have recognized him, never in a thousand years. He had evolved from the brisk, white-coated father of memory into a generic old man. He had old man's yellow skin, old man's bony legs, old man's wet mouth, old man's breath, and old man's wisps of hair, all of which pervaded the room with old man's odour. Somehow, even the sunlight that streamed through the windows had been transformed into old man's sun, the kind of bright, prickly warmth only felt in retirement homes. Frau Mendel's hand was on his shoulder. "Freiherr! Freiherr!" Your son has arrived. Here's Axel.
The old man's skull slowly rose, and Axel looked into his father's watery eyes. Yes, perhaps there was something there that he might have recognized. The pupils were surrounded by a corona of yellow fatty tissue that narrowed the width of iris, but there was a soul looking out through those clouded rings of cobalt blue that Axel recognized as belonging to his father. "Hello, Papa," he said, and was amazed to feel in his own eyes the springing up of tears. Milk? 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 You want milk? Axel turned in some confusion to Frau Mendel. He's just waking up. Usually when he wakes up after his afternoon sleep, he has a glass of warm milk. Papa, it is Axel. Axel, your son. Axel watched the clouds in the eyes begin to clear.
Axel, you are here.
The voice was husked and fogged, but Axel knew it and was transported by it at once to his childhood home in Munster. A great feeling of love overwhelmed him with its own force, and overwhelmed him perhaps more greatly with surprise at its existence. A cold hand came up to pat his own.
Thank you for coming, his father said. It was kind.
Nonsense, not kind. A pleasure.
No, it was kind. I would like you to wheel me outside, to the garden.
Frau Mendel nodded her approval and held the door open while Axel manoeuvred the chair into the corridor. Just follow it along to the end and then turn left, through the door and down the ramp into the garden. If you need anything, there is a button on the arm of the wheelchair. Axel tried to open a conversation about the beauty of the landscape and lake, but was cut off.
That way, Axel, take me that way. Past the cedar of Lebanon, towards the lake. There is a path no one takes.
Axel wheeled his father across the lawn and past the trees as he was bid. He nodded to attendants and loyal family members who were doing much the same as himself all around. One old man was sitting on a bench in pyjamas, talking to himself. On his pyjama jacket, Axel saw with amusement, were pinned more than a dozen medals.
Here. It is private here, his father said, leaning forward to urge the wheelchair on.
Axel pushed him, as directed, along the pathway towards an opening in a variegated box hedge. They went through into a small horseshoe-shaped flower garden.
Pull my chair round so that we can face the entrance, said his father. There, you sit on the bench. Now we will know if anyone comes.
The sun isn't too hot. Perhaps I should fetch a hat.
Never mind the sun. I am a dying man. I'm sure they told you that. What does a dying man want with a hat?
Axel nodded. It seemed a fair point.
When I die, you will inherit my title. You know this.
I haven't given it much thought, Papa.
Liar. I bet you have thought about little else for years. Well, I want to tell you what the title stands for.
It is a mark of distinction for services rendered to the Reich.
Yes, but that is not what I mean. You have no idea why the Führer gave me the honour, have you?
No, Papa.
No one has, or if they did know, they are dead, and the secret has died with them. But if I am to bequeath an honour to you, it is only right, is it not, that I pass on the story of how it was won. There is no land with the title, only this story, so I want you to sit still and listen. Have you learnt how to sit still?
I believe so, Papa.
Good. You may give me a cigarette.
I only smoke a pipe, Papa, and that is with my luggage at the hotel.
Oh, I had been looking forward to a cigarette.
Perhaps I can find you one.
No, sit down. It's of no great matter. At my age, the pleasure lies in the contemplation, not the act. but you will find a bottle of schnapps in the table at the back of my chair.
In the pocket, you mean?
Yes, yes, pocket, that is what I said.
No matter, thought Axel.
Tasha and Tish were not so unlike as words. If that was the extent of the senility he was to look forward to himself, then perhaps age wasn't so much to be feared. He found the bottle, unscrewed the lid, and passed it to his father, who took a large swig and passed it back, his eyes running.
Sit still and listen. Don't talk, just listen.
The story I'm about to tell you is known to very few people in the world. It is a great secret, you understand?
Axel nodded.
It all begins in the small town of Brunau am Inn, Austria, exactly 100 years ago. You've heard of Brunau?
Axel shook his head.
Ha! Exactly. No one has. I have no doubt it is as undistinguished a dorf today as it was then, no different, in fact, from any other dusty little town in that part of the Habsburg Empire. Brunau was a dull provincial place then, and I'm sure it is the same now. Nothing ever happened there. Life went on, birth, marriage, death, history passed it by. But 100 years ago, a young physician in this small town, he made a discovery, an extraordinary discovery, that was to change the world. He had no idea of this, of course, this physician. His name, by the way, was Horst Schenk. He was not an eminent man of science, you must understand. He was merely starting out in life as a family doctor in a small town, full of ideals and hopes, no doubt, in keeping with the age. But academically, he was most undistinguished, I assure you. A second-class brain, at best. Like many of his type and generation, he kept a full and faithful diary of his medical round, which for the most part makes very dull reading indeed. So, we have a dull young doctor in a dull town in a dull part of the world. But the discovery he made, this was not dull, not dull at all. One day, in 1889, a young woman comes to see him, blushing in confusion and distress. Her name is... let me think... Oh, good God, there was a time when I knew Schenk's diary for those years by heart, absolutely by heart. Hitler, that was it. Clara Hitler, née Plotzl, or some such name. This Frau Hitler comes to see her Dr. Schenk because she and her husband have been unable to conceive. At first, the doctor thinks there is nothing unusual in this. Her husband, Alois, some kind of petty official with the customs office, is 54 years old, nearly twice this Clara's age. She has been delivered of 3 babies already, but none has survived infancy. Alois has fathered plenty of children from other liaisons, but maybe now he has simply reached the end of his fruitful life, you understand? Or maybe the 3 unsuccessful births the wife has undergone, maybe they have mangled up her insides. Maybe also, Schenk notes in his diary, there is truth to the rumour that this pair are in fact uncle and niece. Such are the ways of these provincial backwaters, and we all know the dangers attendant upon the union of such close blood relatives. Frau Hitler is desperate to have a child, however, and begs for the doctor's help. He examines her, finds nothing wrong, aside from evidence of beatings, again common enough in those places in those times, so he suggests that she keep trying, notes the circumstances in his diary, and thinks no more about it. The good doctor was surprised, however, when 2 days later another young woman, a Frau Leona Hartmann, came to him reporting a very similar set of circumstances. She was the mother of 2 healthy young girls, and for a year she and her husband had tried to produce another child without success. Now, it so happens that the Hartmanns lived in the same street as the Hitlers. Schenk noted this coincidence in his diary, but attached no special significance to it. But by the end of the following week, 2 more women, a Frau Maria Steinitz and a Frau Claudia Mann, had also been to see him, also complaining that they were unable to conceive. They too lived in the same street. A coincidence. It must all have been a coincidence, Schenck decided. For the very next day, he attended a birth in that selfsame street, and the mother was safely delivered of a healthy boy. No complications, no problems. Indeed, in the next door house but one, the wife of the family was joyfully, robustly pregnant too. We must not forget that Austria was a Roman Catholic country then, and these were the days before the phrase family planning had ever been heard. Just one of those strange coincidences then, which doctors often find in their daily round. No significance, no importance. Just bad luck on those barren women. It was only as he was leaving the house that Schenck looked across at the houses opposite, and it struck him that all the women who had been to see him lived on the other side of the street. Schenck had naturally examined these women in so far as he was able, and was not able to find anything that, superficially at least, could explain such a strangely localized outbreak of infertility. It soon turned out, however, that there was no need to examine the women further. After a day's thought, Schenck persuaded one of the husbands, Otto Steinitz, who was a cousin of his, to provide him with a sample of his semen. The sample he was given, he examined under a microscope. He found it to be entirely free of spermatozoa. He persuaded other men on the same side of the street, the west side, to offer him samples. Some refused indignantly, but of those who donated, all were found to have entirely sterile seminal fluid. He tested the men on the east side of the street and found that their sperm count was entirely normal. What do you think of that? Axel, faintly disgusted by the hand-rubbing glee and chuckling relish with which his father was telling the story, shrugged. The soil, I suppose. Possibly the water supply, some spermicidal agent. Exactly. A child could see that. Even our hero, the dull Dr. Schenck, was smart enough to realize that the answer must lie in either of those directions. The most obvious explanation, the correct explanation, as it turned out, was to be found with the water supply. Schenck discovered that there was a mains pipe that divided at the head of the street, feeding an east cistern and a west cistern. Water was manually forced up by the householders from pumps in the back garden of each house. Schenck immediately took numerous samples of the water from both sides, tested it on pigs, and then, in great alarm, alerted the health officers in Innsbruck. There is an especially amusing diary entry written in highly flustered 19th century euphemism in which Schenck describes the business of persuading male pigs to yield up their semen for examination. The poor man was not a vet after all, eh? More schnapps, please. Axel passed over the bottle, marvelling at the vulgarity of the older generation. The founding generation, they called themselves. They had no time for the mealy-mouthed primness of the young. A true Nazi's language wears no fine silk, as Glöder used to say, except in the company of women, naturally, when respect and propriety are all. So, said the old man, licking schnapps from his lips, there you have it. The householders on the western side of the street, from that day onwards, obtained their water from their healthy neighbours on the east side. A few years later, the households were switched to a direct main supply, and the problem was never heard of again. Not a single new outbreak of male sterility was ever recorded. Schenck records in his diary, however, that not one of the infected men ever regained his fertility. Each of them remained sterile until the day they died. The authorities in Innsbruck reported the matter to Vienna. The leading Viennese scientists, epidemiologists, pathologists, histologists, chemists, biologists, geologists, mineralogists, botanists, they all analyzed samples of the water, but no one could discover what was wrong with it or what substance it might contain that had done this damage. Minute quantities of the water were tested on animals, and it was found to have the same permanent sterilizing effect on all male mammals. "That's simply astounding," said Axel, his scientific interest now fully awakened. "Astounding indeed, astounding and utterly unprecedented. Nowhere in the world has such a case ever been reported before or since." "I never heard about it or read about it, surely." "Of course you didn't. This was Imperial Austro-Hungary, and in the interest of averting panic and prurient interest, the matter was never published. Schenck was not allowed to write a paper on the epidemic, a restriction which annoyed him intensely, frustrating his dreams of medical glory and world fame. He moans endlessly about this in his diary." "So, a medical mystery, not by any means the strangest in the history of science, but unusual and intriguing all the same. Nothing more was heard of this strange contamination of the water in Brunau for many years. The Great War came and went, followed by the collapse of the Habsburg Empire. Finally, in 1937, more than 50 years after Clara Hitler paid him that first tearful visit, Horst Schenck dies. He had managed to preserve 350-litre carboys of Brunau water, all that remained of his original sample. These he leaves, together with his diary, to his old medical school in Innsbruck, Austria. That very year, I should remind you, Austria has become part of the Greater German Reich. The newly formed Reichsministerium of Science instantly impounds the diary and the samples of Brunau water and throws down a massive blanket of secrecy. The scientists fall on these flagons of strange water like lions on antelopes. They analyze it, they test it, they bombard it with radiation, they swirl it round in centrifuges, they vibrate it in vibrators, they condense it in condensers, evaporate it in evaporators, mix it, boil it, dry it, freeze it. They do everything they can to unlock its tantalizing secret. The Führer, you see, he understands the importance of this Brunau water to the security of the Reich. The glamorous men at the Göttingen Institute are dreaming up a bomb for him, but perhaps that won't work. A little insurance is important to him. If Bolshevism cannot be eradicated one way, maybe it can be eradicated another. That is how the thinking went. Well, as we all know, Göttingen, in the end, produced the goods for him. The bomb was born. Goodbye, Moscow. See you later, Leningrad. The freedom of the Reich was secured and Europe set free. So much is public history. But meanwhile, two very brilliant men at Münster continue to work on this damned Brunau water. They are, of course, your godfather, Johannes Kramer, and myself, your noble parent. We had been given access to all the previous research, everything from Schenck's original diary to all the latest analyses of this frustrating fluid. You'll find the diary in the back table of my chair, the back pocket of the chair. Take it out. Axel took out the diary, an old leather book, stained and frayed at its edges, and held together with a brass clasp. "That is the volume that covers the years 1886 to 1901. Very tedious reading it is too, most of it, but there, it's yours. No one knows I've held on to it all these years. Keep it now. Keep it." "I'll keep it," Axel assured him. He noticed a note of hysteria creeping into his father's voice, which he did not like. "It was I, not Kramer, who unlocked the secret of Brunau water. We worked together. He was the senior partner, of course. But it was I who succeeded in isolating and synthesizing the active spermicidal compound. What we would now understand as a freak genetic mutation, that science was then in its infancy, of course. had somehow taken place naturally in such organic matter as existed in the cistern. The effect on the male body took place at such a deep level within the human gene that it was no surprise previous generations of doctors had been unable to comprehend its working. I was incapable of grasping the full meaning myself until much, much later. But I was able to synthesize the agent. That is the point. It was brilliant work, brilliant, years ahead of its time.
Axel stared at his father, at the bright light shining from his watering eyes and the twisting hands in his lap. The knuckle bones writhed under the skin, and every yellowed ball and socket of their joints showed through.
The Führer was delighted, ecstatic. I had met him before, of course. He had personally come to open the Institute of Advanced Medical Studies at Münster University and made one of his great speeches about science and nature. But that was just a handshake and a long lineup. This time, this time, we were provided with a car, the long black DW2s, you remember them? We were driven to Berlin, to the Reichschancellery itself, and there we spent 4 hours alone with just the Führer, Reichsminister Himmler, and Reichsminister Heydrich. Just the three of them, and Kramer and me. Imagine! Afterwards, dinner with dancing and music, an incredible day. Perhaps you remember me going. I brought back presents and a signed photograph of the Führer. Axel did remember. To Axel Bauer, grew up to be as fine a man as your father, Rudolf Gloder. He still had it somewhere, in a trunk in Cambridge, he supposed. Axel remembered, too, standing on the back of a sofa, his face pressed against the glass window of the morning room, waiting for his father to return. He remembered the great black car swinging into their street, a flag on each front wing. Other children across the street stopped and stared, he remembered, dropped their footballs, or stood up in their bicycles to watch. He remembered the chauffeur stepping smartly out to open the door for Papa. He remembered the smiles, the hugs, the happiness pervading the whole household for weeks later, until they moved from Münster forever. The Führer had a great enterprise for us to undertake, Axie. He wanted Kramer and me to synthesize this water Brunau on a large scale. He wanted us to set up a small manufacturing plant, somewhere discreet. We chose a little out-of-the-way town in Poland called Auschwitz. The Brunau water was to be produced in the greatest secrecy, of course, and with superhuman care. Each flask to be numbered, sealed in wax, and accounted for. They were to be used in a great task, the greatest task then facing us, now that Russia had been defeated and absorbed into the Reich, and Europe was stable and free of Bolshevism. The water of Brunau was to be used, in the Führer's words, to cleanse the Reich, as Hercules had cleansed the Augean stables. All the filth of Europe will be washed away. For my part in this historic achievement, a barony was bestowed upon me in 1949. That is what you are inheriting, Axel. That is the title you will shortly own. Freiherr Bauer, the destroyer of a whole race of men. God forgive me, son. God forgive us all. Christ Jesus, have mercy upon me.
10 minutes later, Axel pressed the red button on the wheelchair's right arm and walked calmly through the gap in the hedge. He saw a figure in white running towards him across the lawn. Is there a problem, sir? My father. I can find no pulse. I think he is dead.
Official history. Talking in his sleep. Bauer died in a Berlin retirement home, July 1989. said Brown. Kramer, the senior partner in their little manufacturing enterprise, he had curled up his toes 15 years earlier. No one is quite sure where. Now, you may be wanting to know how we found all this out. Geez, you guys have sure as heck fire got some smart agents working for you, is what you're thinking. Sorry, but that just ain't so. We know all this on account of Professor Bauer's son, Axel, who has become our friend. Weren't for him, we wouldn't know jack poop. I dunked the last of the chocolate chip cookies into cold coffee. My father was looking down at his hands, which were folded neatly on the table in front of him. Hubbard's eyes were closed. No one was watching me, but I still maintained a face that I hoped was innocent of any traces of the thundering torment inside. "That pretty much brings us to the end of the tale," said Brown, turning to the window and looking through the thick velvet curtains at the brightening sky. "Axel decided to stop by outside the American consular gates in Venice, Italy, 2 years ago and ring the doorbell. He was in town as a member of a European physics convention representing the institution he was working for at the time. Needn't concern us where that was. And he asked to be allowed to come over to us. So happens that he worked in a field which was of great interest to the scientific community here, so it'd been worth his weight in gold to us, whatever his background. But see, the reason he wanted to defect was guilt. Couldn't take the discovery that he was the son of the man who wiped the Jews from the face of Europe. So after we had smuggled him safely out of Italy and gotten him on United States soil, he spilled us the whole story between great gulps of grief and howls of anti-Reich rage. Showed us the original Austrian doctor's diary and all the documentation his father had managed to keep. Enough to convince us that it was all true. The whole nasty tale, from chestnut soup to pumpkin pie. My father straightened his back and looked up at the ceiling. "But why wasn't this story announced? Why wasn't the world immediately informed? I should imagine the propaganda value alone would be what, Colonel? It's history. It's over. What's done is done. May sound harsh, but that's a fact. Everyone responsible, so far as we know, is dead. Europe has changed. Our relationship with Europe has changed. What would happen if we told the world? All the Jews in America and Canada would be up in arms, for sure. Every liberal and intellectual would leap on the moral bandwagon and cry vengeance. Then what? Armageddon? Either that or a mighty embarrassing climb down. Who wins either way? It's history. It's all just history. Might as well make a stink about the Black Hole of Calcutta or the Salem witch trials." My father nodded his head briefly. He tried to take it well, but I saw his shoulders sag a little and a tired look come into his eyes. Too much pride there, I supposed, to allow him to express any outrage at the nuts and bolts of realpolitik. Only a worn-out, "Very well, then, it's your world. I'll leave it to you and your generation," kind of resignation. "So," said Brown, "we return to the cute part of this little story. Me? I've read the diary of the Austrian doctor, Horst Schenck. But Mr. Hubbard here, he hasn't read it, have you, Tom?" Hubbard shook his head. "My agency director has read it. Axel Bauer, now working for us with a new name and a heart full of vengeance against all things European, he brought it to us, so you can be sure as shooting that he's read it. We allowed the President of the United States to take a peep at a neatly typed digest. Hell, it was only polite. The Vice President, well, now, he's never had so much as a smell of the consarn thing. Same goes for the Secretary for State. Far as I know, only 12 people in this whole country
have ever even heard of Horse Chenk's diary. So what we need you to tell us, Mikey, is how come, in conversation with your friend Mr. Steve Burns yesterday afternoon, how come you attached such importance to that self-same one-horse township of Brunau am Inn, where the whole story begins? And how come you mentioned the names Pulzel and Hitler, the very names of the first couple to visit Dr. Schenck all the way back in 1889, and Auschwitz, where Bauer and Kramer ended up in 1942. How come you know about that? I think we have a right to know. You see what I'm saying? All eyes were on me now. What harm could they do me? The worst crime I had committed in their eyes was that I had happened upon some sensitive information. They didn't really believe I was some engineered clone of the real Michael Young, planted in Princeton to spy on the United States government. They couldn't believe that. It was unthinkable. They could never guess, not in a million, million years, the real truth, which was more unthinkable yet. That most awful truth that only now was rearing up dragon-shaped from the swamp of emotions within me, that most awful truth that it was I, Michael Young, who had contaminated the waters of Brunau, that it was I, Michael Young, who was the genocide. They would find it easier to believe that I was an android from another galaxy, or a shaman endowed with paranormal powers, to whom the diary of Horst Schenck had appeared in a dream. Anything would be easier for them to believe than the truth. It was not what I could tell Hubbard or Brown that consumed me, however. What consumed me was what they had already told me, what they had told me about Leo, about Axel, or whatever name he might now be using. What we had done, and done, I now saw, more out of a desire to relieve Leo of his miserable inheritance of guilt than out of any altruism or high humanitarian purpose, what we had done had not loosened the tentacles of history that had been gripping him so remorselessly back in that earlier world. No. Those tentacles were now clutched about his throat more tightly than ever. They had strangled the life out of a whole people, out of the whole world. And me? It was one hell of a big Wednesday for Keanu Young, PH dude, the history surfer hanging nine on the Point Break of yesterday, tubing it through the big rollers of tide and time. Why had I agreed to help Leo in the first place? Cockiness? A desire to feel big? No, it was simpler than that, I decided. Stupidity. It was just plain stupidity. Or perhaps, at a pinch, stupidity's sweet baby brother, innocence. Maybe even cowardice. The world I lived in was too scary for me, so why not make another? We're waiting, Mikey. Hubbard was tapping a pencil gently on the table. I took a deep breath. It was a gamble, but I had kind of gotten used to the ways of history by now. I was beginning to be able to read her. Somehow I knew it just had to be. Well, you know, I said, I've been thinking about this, and I guess I must have met him. Brown's friendly eyes rested on me. Met who, cowboy? This guy you were talking about. Not met him exactly, seen him. My father slapped the table impatiently with the palm of his hand. Which guy, Michael? Talk sense. This Axel Baum, or whatever his name was. Bauer? Axel Bauer? You think you've met Axel Bauer? Hubbard could not hide the excitement in his voice. Well, it might not have been him, I said, considering carefully, but it's the only explanation I can think of. When did you meet him? Where? The two questions simultaneously from Hubbard and Brown. I swallowed silently. This was where the gamble lost or won. I chose Hubbard's as the easiest eyes to meet. When,
I'm not so sure. It was a couple of weeks ago. On a train, New Jersey Transit. I took a trip one time up to New York City. There was this guy in the seat across from me. I mean, it might not have been him. I mean, your guy, for all I know, he's on the West Coast. Loathsome as the gesture might be, I came within a touch of executing the exultant Macaulay Culkin yes, complete with triumphal fist pump. Because I could see, I could clearly see from the expression, from the lack of expression in Hubbard's eyes, that I had hit it right on the nose. Leo had been relocated here, to Princeton. I might well have seen him on a New Jersey Transit Company train. It wasn't beyond the bounds of possibility. You're saying you talked to Axel Bauer on a train from Princeton to New York City? No, not at all. We never exchanged a word, as far as I can remember. He was asleep the whole journey. It's just that, well, he spoke. Brown's eyebrows shot up. And I know it sounds crazy, I said, but I was fascinated. I'd never heard anyone talk in their sleep before. I mean, really talk. There was just him and me, no one else close by, so I started to write it down, you know. I thought it was cool. Cool? I don't understand. Oh, I'm sorry, that's a kind of new slang thing. I thought it was neat. I thought maybe I could use it, being a philosophy major and all, so I wrote some of the words down. I could sense Hubbard wanting to look at Brown, and Brown willing him not to turn round or show any sign of weakness or hesitancy. Anyhow, when I was back in school that night, in my dorm, I started playing around with some of the words I had written down. There were lots of them. Martyr was one, or maybe it was a woman's name, Martha. Munster, he said, you know, like the cheese. Nazi. Hitler. But I'm pretty sure it was Adolf, not what you said. Alois? I remember Adolf, but of course it was hard to tell. I mean, the guy was asleep, right? We were in a moving train. Then there was Pölzl. That's what it sounded like. Brunau am Inn. He kept saying that. What happened in Brunau am Inn, Upper Austria? Guess that's why I always had it down as a place name. Time after time he said that. Another word sounded like Schickelgruber to me, but obviously that doesn't mean anything to you, so maybe I had that down wrong. And he said that other name you mentioned, Kramer, only he said it in full, Johannes Paul Kramer. Pretty sure that was it. And Auschwitz, another one too, Dachau, it sounded like, but that doesn't seem to mean anything to you either. So I started to write these names down and try and construct a story out of them. I mean, it was obvious the guy was German, and he was old. Only some of the names he mentioned were English. I mean, real English English. Cambridge University, St. Matthew's College, Hawthorne Tree Court, Porter's Lodge, King's Parade, stuff like that. Didn't mean diddly to me, but I tried to make up a history for him, like about how maybe he was a refugee from the old Nazi days. And this really got to me. For days, I was going around thinking real hard about this old guy. Something in his eyes. There was something spooky in his eyes. Really bugged me. I thought maybe I could write a short story about him, a movie, even. You know how you get these crazy notions in your head? I decided he was a German Nazi who had gone to live in England, but that he had some guilty secret. I started to do some research about where he might go and what he might do. You know, looked up Cambridge, England in the library. Stuff like that. Then last night, I got wasted with some of the guys. I bang my head on a wall and my mind goes all weird. I'm going around the place next morning, half in and half out of this imagined world. I forget the most basic things. The Gettysburg Address. I mean, geez, can you beat that? But at the same time, I remember all this weird stuff. Clearly, like it was more real than the real world, and my accent goes all bluey. I shook my head with the wonder of it all, as if I were still waking up. My father leaned forward and gripped my arm.
For the Lord's sake, Michael, how many times must I tell you to speak properly? Why is it always stuff and weird and neat and guise? You're a Princeton man. Can't you utter a single coherent sentence in decent English? My kid's the same, said Hubbard, and he's at Harvard. He's at Harvard, and he can speak? I said with incredulity. You must be very proud, sir. The tension was easing a little. I could sense that. Leo had taken flight from St. Matthew's, Cambridge, to Venice, from Venice to Washington. Now he was here, in Princeton. I was as sure of that as I was of anything. There was, surely, every possibility that he had been on a train to New York City in the last month. My memory loss could cover any gaps. Hubbard and Brown would have a hard time proving I was an out-and-out liar. They might suspect me, but what kind of danger to anyone or anything did I pose? What took you to New York, Mikey? Hubbard asked. I shrugged. Hey, what else? The Yankees. You were a Yankees fan? You should see his bedroom, my father said. His sheets are black and white striped. Yeah, me, I'm a fan of the Brooklyn Dodgers. Somebody's got to be, I said. Brown spoke for the first time. This man on the train, you say his eyes got to you. Really bugged me. Seems strange, said Brown, that the eyes of a sleeping man should have such an effect. He woke up when we got to New York, I said, my mind frantically racing to remember something Steve had mentioned earlier. Not Grand Central. It wasn't Grand Central Station. What the pants was it called? Ah, got it. When we stopped at Penn Station, he stood up and I saw his eyes and, you know, on top of this, like, monologue he'd been coming out with. He wasn't wearing eyeglasses then? Brown sounded surprised. Nope, I said with conviction. Though, come to think, I screwed my eyes up as if trying to picture the scene. Come to think, there was a pair of glasses in the breast pocket of his coat. Yeah, I'm pretty sure of that. And what colour were these remarkable eyes? Brightest blue you ever saw. Kind of younger than his complexion, if you know what I mean. A real piercing cobalt blue. And was his beard white or grey? Beard? Double pants. This was a problem. He had a beard at Cambridge when I knew him, but that was another life. Then he was Leo Zuckerman, living out the identity his father had left him with. That was a Jewish identity, and Leo had played it to the hilt. But would he have a beard now? Very few of the older people I had seen in Princeton had beards. He would want to blend in, surely, as much as possible. On the other hand, if he was clean-shaven in Germany, maybe he had grown a beard as part of his new identity in the United States. It was a tough one.
Simple question, my friend, said Brown. Was the beard white or grey?
Well, it's a simple enough question, okay, I said, frowning in some perplexity. But see, I'm trying to work out whether you're laying traps because you think I'm lying, or whether this man we're talking about really did have a beard when you knew him, and it's just a misunderstanding, because the guy I'm talking about, he was clean-shaven. His hair was kind of silvery-grey, salt and pepper, I guess you'd call it, receding up to about here.
And if we showed you photographs of a few people, you'd be able to pick him out.
Every time, I said, all my assurance back again. This was not a face I'd ever forget. Brown sat down at the table for the first time.
Well, son, he said, I must confess that when I asked you to tell me how you knew about Bruno, I could not begin to imagine what you were going to say. Professor Simon Taylor, as you might have guessed, he told us about you. Said there was something maybe a little fishy going on. Might be worth our attention. We took the liberty of dropping by and following you about the town yesterday afternoon. When I heard you talking about the Hitlers and Brunau Am Inn and all, just playing out in the open air like that, I gotta tell you, I darn near jumped clean out of my slacks. Seemed to me just incredible when a young college student could come up with those names, still be on the level, and according to Hoyle. But I guess your explanation is the only one that makes sense. You listen to an old man talking in his sleep. Maybe I should have worked it out for myself, like Sherlock Holmes used to say. When you have eliminated the impossible, then what you got left, no matter how unlikely, well, it just plain must be the truth. It was Hubbard's turn to stand now. He drew back the curtains, and the strong white light of dawn filled the room, making my eyes ache. My father rose too, unsteadily. "So can we take our son home now?" "You can do what the Sam Hill you please with him, Colonel. I'm only sorry to have taken up so much of your time. But you heard the story I had to tell. It was worth checking out." "I understand. And you understand, don't you, Mikey, that oath you swore?" I nodded as I, too, stood and stretched. Goose pimples were breaking out on my thighs in the chilly air. I couldn't believe I was still wearing the same damn pair of chino shorts I had pulled on the previous morning. A sudden thought struck me. "What about Steve?" I asked. "What have you done with him?" "Done with him? We haven't done anything with him, Mikey. He was back in his dormitory on campus hours ago."
"You're quite wrong about him, you know," I said. "All that suspected homosexual stuff. I don't know where you got that, but it's not true. It's just not true."
Brown's eyes widened slightly. "No? Well, we're obliged for the information, Mikey." He nodded to me slowly, and I felt another chill run through me as he swung round to face my father. "You fixing to go straight on home, Colonel? We made a reservation at the Peacock Inn for you in Bayard Lane. Fine place, very comfortable. Maybe more convenient."
I turned quickly to my father. "That's a much better idea, Dad, sir. Shit, what on earth do I call him? Let's go there and have breakfast. Much better than driving all the way to Connecticut."
Oh, no, I wasn't leaving Princeton. Not until I'd found Bauer, Zuckerman, whatever he was called now, wherever he was now.
Secret History. A Lonely Life. "Well, now, this is what I call nice," my mother said, standing in the narrow hallway of the Peacock Inn, the boards cracking beneath her feet.
"Like an English hotel," my father agreed,
with a decisive, approving nod. An English hotel, I thought. Right. White-painted steps had led us up to an outer porch, the kind on which old folks sit knitting in rocking chairs while their grandchildren hide their baseball card collections in secret caches in the crawl space below. Inside there was no plastic, no smoked glass, no nylon carpeting, no mock Raj cane furniture, no grey rag rolling or futile stenciling on the walls, no pale green pseudo-chintzes, no collection of accessorized prints in ash frames, no scream of computer printout behind the reception desk, no cream plastic portcullis slammed down over a closed bar, no clattering of discarded peanuts through whining vacuum cleaner hoses in distant function rooms, no reek of last night's Cuban evening, no forlorn air of minimally staffed polyester-trousered failure. Instead, it was pleasantly dark, homey, and in an unforced, unpretentious Grandma Moses kind of way, elegant and stylish. "When were you last in an English hotel?" I asked my father. He grunted noncommittally, and we passed through into the dining room. Maybe under the Nazi hegemony, all the hotels were still Agatha Christie palaces or cheery Margaret Lockwood boarding houses. I doubted it somehow. The breakfast was good here. No maple syrup to drizzle on bacon and famous pancakes, but huge fluffy muffins, shining Danish pastries, jugs of juice, huge china breakfast cups of coffee, and a big plate of fruit. In an English hotel, they would have called it a fresh fruit platter. But here, the woman serving us, who looked as if she might have been the owner, said as she set it down on our table, "And here's a plate of fruit for you." I liked that. I bit into one of the muffins, and a fat blueberry that I had no idea was hiding inside exploded its juice onto my tongue. "Mmm," I said. "I had no idea I was so hungry." "That's it, honey. You tuck in," said my mother, slicing a grape in half and popping it into her mouth between forefinger and thumb, somehow as if she had gloves on. "The young man who drove us down," said my father, who was tackling one of those pastries on which half an apricot sits, face down, looking like an egg yolk, "will be back in 6 hours, so we should all be able to get plenty of sleep before the journey home." "About that," I said, "I think I'll stay on." My mother dropped her knife onto the plate and turned anxious eyes on me. "Darling." "No, really," I said, "my memory is coming back all the time. I got, you know, work to do. It's catch-up time." "But you're still sick. You ought to be getting some rest. Your memory will come back at home just as much as here. More. Think how pleased to see you Bella would be. You could go with her to all your favourite places." Bella? This was a new one. "I'll write to her," I said, patting my mother's hand. "She'll understand." My mother let go of my hand as if she'd been stung and let out a squeak. "Honey, you see, you just aren't well yet." "Really, Mom, I'm fine, truly." "Your brain is still a little funny, writing to a dog. That's just not normal, dear, and you know it." "Oops." It was a joke, Mom, that's all. I was just kidding you." "Oh." A little mollified, my mother regained her composure. "Well, that's very silly." We were talking in that strangely lowered tone in which families conduct conversations in restaurants, as if every other word was cancer. The effort was exhausting me. "Look," I said in a normal voice that sounded like a bellow after what had gone before, "I have to stay here. There's only a few more weeks in the semester." My father looked up from his newspaper. "Some sense in that, Mary." "It's not like I'm running a fever or anything. If I forget stuff, Steve will remind me." My father frowned. "Who is this Steve Burns?" he asked. "I don't recall you mentioning him before." "Well, if not Steve, then Scott or Ronnie or Todd, any of the guys." "Todd Williams is a very nice young man," my mother said. "You remember his sister, Emily? You used to go to dances with her when the Williamses lived in Bridgeport." "Right, sure, nice people. Scott will look after me."
"Well, it's up to you, of course," my father said. He leaned forward and lowered his voice. "If I know these government people, they will still be interested in you."
"Are you saying they didn't believe me?"
"Don't be foolish. I'm just saying, son, that they check things out, every detail. They're very thorough. Once a file is open, it stays open. So just remember not to talk to anybody about all this and stay out of trouble." I nodded.
"Anybody want that last muffin?" I made my way back through campus, feeling completely alone in Princeton for the first time. I didn't know where Steve lived, where his dorm was, the places he frequented, or how I could set about finding out. It occurred to me that Steve must have been so frightened by the events of last night that from now on he would do his best to steer clear of me. It looked like I would have to do what had to be done, all on my lonesome. I had seen my parents off from the Peacock Inn with a cheerful wave, and in my pocket crinkled $500 in crisp new bills. "See, I can't remember the number I have to punch in to get cash out of the wall," I had explained to my father. "It's just clean gone from my head." he had disgorged with surprising ease. Perhaps we were rich? Maybe it wouldn't be so bad living in this America of peacock inns and wealthy fathers and dogs called Bella. There was something, though, something in the air here that I didn't like. Partly it was what they had said about Steve, partly that I had a sense, almost from the beginning, that something was missing here. It wasn't just that rock and roll seemed to have passed the place by. Things were neat and peachy. There were no dudes and nothing was cool. There was a lot of gee and gosh and darn, which didn't square with what I knew about the States from movies. There again, maybe that was just Ivy League talk. Princeton, I supposed, was hardly representative. Yet there was something else, too, something wrong. I heard a motor behind me and stepped aside to let a lawn tractor drive past. The elderly driver saluted his thanks and stepped down to load a length of hose onto the trailer.
"Hey there, Mikey."
A hand fell on my shoulder. "Oh, hi," I said. It was Scott, or possibly Todd, or Ronnie even, one of the three.
"How's the limey?"
"Hey, I'm doing fine," I said. "Just fine. Everything's getting much better. Back to my old American self."
"Oh, yeah? You're still talking like the King of England."
"Yeah, I know," I sighed. "But things are coming back. Doc Ballinger did say it would take a few days."
"So we're not going to see you on the mound?"
"Excuse me?" "Oh, the mound. No, I think baseball is out for the moment." I shuddered at the prospect. "Bummer, I know, but there you go."
"Darn it, Mikey. You picked one heck of a time. Hey, watch it!"
Scott, or Todd, or whoever he was, leaped aside as the lawn tractor chugged past us. It didn't seem to me that there was any danger of his being hit, but he was furious all the same.
"Hey, you!" he called out.
The driver stopped the tractor and looked fearfully at Todd, Scott, Ronnie over his shoulder.
"Me, sir?" "Yes, you, boy. Why the hell don't you watch where you're going?"
"I'm sorry, sir. I thought there was plenty room."
"Well, next time you keep your Negro eyes open, boy. You hear?"
"Yes, sir. I'm sorry, sir." I watched, pulverized with shock. At once I knew what it was that had been missing from this place, and felt foolish and guilty for not having noticed straight away. All the students I had seen were white. Every one of them. As white as shame. The tractor drove away.
"Coons!" Scott, Ronnie, Todd spat on the pathway. "Ain't got no respect."
"You're full of it," I said.
"Say what?"
"Respect," I said. "You're full of respect."
"Oh, sure," he nodded. "Sure, I have respect. So, Mikey, what you up to today?"
"Oh, I got work to catch up on," I said, my throat dry. "I'll see you later, maybe."
"Sure thing. So long, bud."
"Oh, by the way," I called after him, knowing now that I needed Steve again